You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Daniel Orozco spent over a decade working in the accounts payable and human resources department of a university hospital before he embarked on his career as a fiction writer. He was already in his early 30s when Orientation, a short story for which he received much critical acclaim, was first published, and now it's the title story of a new collection of his work from Faber & Faber. Very pleased that Orientation and Other Stories has brought Daniel Orozco from Idaho to our show. Welcome.
Thank you.
It's been about 15 years since Orientation was published. Do you work very slowly?
Yes, I work very slowly.
How slowly is that?
I can spend I'm getting faster now, but I can spend a couple of weeks on a paragraph. I can spend an afternoon on a sentence.
Is this like what Flaubert talked about? Are you doing the same sort of thing, just worrying about each word and going back and forth of your mind?
Yeah. What did he say? This morning I took a comma out, and this afternoon I put it back in. It is a kind of worrying over the word choice, rhythm, syntax. I'm always reading the stuff aloud while I'm working on it, and somehow – irregardless of what it's about, it just needs to somehow sound right.
Well, you teach now.
Yes.
If a student told you he or she worked that way, would you say, you know, it'd be better just to write a first draft as quickly as possible and then go back and burnish it?
I would tell him that. So in a sense, I'm a hypocrite because I have my writing style, but it isn't any way I'd want a student to learn how to write at all.
I mentioned that you had an office job for many years before you became a writer. What did you do there?
I worked in it's hard to be particular about office work because the titles are so arcane and vague. I was an administrative assistant in the Department of Nursing and in the Human Resources Department, and that involved working with a very specialized piece of paper that employed people and changed their status. It was called the PAF. They even had an acronym for it. And I knew how to handle that complex piece of paper, and that got me jobs in various departments through the university system.
Were you writing at the same time?
No, I wasn't writing at the same time. I didn't start writing until about a year and a half after I decided to leave and go back to school.
To become a writer.
Yeah, yeah. When I graduated from college years ago, I never wanted to go back to school. I hated college. I was a terrible student. I was lazy. I was shy. And then when I turned about 32, I went, I need to go back to school. So go figure.
But then I'm assuming that Orientation comes out of your experiences at the hospitals.
Yes. Yes, absolutely.
It's written from the perspective of an HR employee taking a new hire through the first day, and the reader becomes a character in the tale as a consequence. What got you think about using that approach?
I was a temp between jobs, and I was always the new person in the office, and so I'd been taken on those tours. And the thing that struck me about some of those tours was what you were finding out about people that you may necessarily have not wanted to know. Some of the tour was a little more indiscreet, a little more revealing than I'd wanted. That so-and-so, he drinks, so avoid him after 1 o'clock, that kind of thing.
Well, we always assume that the people we work with don't know as much about us as they actually know.
Yes. And
then we also assume that they're not going to tell everybody.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. I mean, one of the things that I found and still find fascinating about the office as a workplace is that you can work next to somebody for 10, 15, 20 years, and you can never have been to their house, never have met the husband or the kids whose photo is on the desk. And I think that that is a remarkable thing. There's something kind of awful about it.
But the tone of that story is almost devoid of emotion. How did you envision your narrator as somebody who just delivered pretty much the same speech every day?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I guess ultimately finding the voice in that story was kind of like finding the voice of a god, kind of. Someone who is remote, removed, not necessarily cruel, but not necessarily kind either, and all-knowing. And when I first wrote that story and it was workshopped years ago, everyone had a problem with it because they were saying, well, we don't know anything about the narrator. You need to tell us about the narrator. I didn't know anything about the narrator when I was on those tours, and it's not about the narrator. So
one of the reasons that the story is so effective is that you didn't follow their advice. And how did it – it was read on This American Life 15 years ago.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Was that the first time people heard it, or had you already published it?
It was read – it came out about 15 years ago, and then it was read right after that. So, yeah, that was probably the first time folks heard it.
And do you think of yourself as a short story writer? You, I hear you're working on a novel.
Yeah.
And considering what you just said about how slowly you work.
Well, I did say, too, that I'm going faster because I kind of have to. I love the short story form. I think it is a precise and exacting form. I think it's closer to poetry than it is to the novel. I basically started writing a novel, frankly, out of a financial necessity years ago when I was peddling the collection. I was told, we need a novel. And so I started putting that together, and now the story collection's coming out. But I actually like the novel I started. I kind of like the process of working on it.
Well, the big difference is that a short story has to be concentrated, mm-hmm. or usually has to be concentrated. In a novel, you can digress as much as you want,
mm-hmm.
but language can be just as precise in either case, can't it?
It can, but not for long stretches. There's a poet named Chris Wyman who wrote a great review where he talked about the necessary white noise in a novel, where he says that sometimes a character just has to write, he got up and opened the door. You can't do anything with that. And to give language the kind of a clarity and precision always in a novel, he argues, is not it would be unreadable. And that makes sense to me.
In these stories, there are very human daily rituals interspersed with dark comedy, sexual tension, even violence. And in many of them, the moments seem to pop up shockingly from out of nowhere. Mm-hmm. Is that how they occur to you while you're writing them? Or do you know you're writing to that surprise? We're not talking about an O. Henry surprise.
No. I know I'm writing to something because, I mean, the way I write a story is it has movements and there are rises and valleys. And so I know I'm arriving at a place where something has to happen, but I haven't necessarily figured out what it is yet. And so I want to be as surprised as the reader is when I get to it. So that's part of the writing process there as well.
My guest is Daniel Orozco, whose short story collection, Orientation and Other Stories, has just been released by Faber and Faber. One section of the book, Hunger Tales, is a series of stories of individuals dealing with food obsessions. How much of these food issues were you aware of before you started writing about them? Did you have to do research?
Well, one of the characters in that story browses in a supermarket all night. And I certainly did that research because I did that a lot when I lived in Seattle.
But you are not an extremely obese man, as one of these characters is confined to his apartment.
Yeah, I do understand. I get the relationship with food. It's not just to nourish your gullet. There's something else going on. And that's what all of these stories are about.
Well, I notice in a number of the stories, characters are only talked about in the second person, not named.
Mm-hmm.
Why not give them names? Isn't giving names part of the fun of writing?
One reason is I have a hard time coming up with names. But the other reason is that it does – I guess ultimately it doesn't seem to matter. I mean, one could argue that what I'm doing by not giving them a name is somehow robbing them of their identity and making them every man. But they don't feel like every man to me. They're very precise. They're very specific. I think it's just a matter of not getting around to naming them. And then when I was done with the story, simply deciding, you know what, I don't think they need a name.
One of the stories definitely has a name, Somoza's Dream, based on the former president, or I guess we could say dictator of Nicaragua, Anastasio Somoza. Your family background is from Nicaragua?
Mm-hmm. That's right. My mother and father were both born there.
And did you visit there when you were growing up?
Never visited.
But was Somoza part of the heritage, the stories that your parents told?
Not a lot. When they raised me, they said, you're in America now, you become an American. So we did not get a lot of the cultural background.
Although one of the oddities of this story is that he was assassinated when he was in exile.
Yeah.
In Paraguay.
That's right. Yeah. The assassins actually wrote a book about it several years ago, which I read. And it's a fascinating story about how they planned it. They put it together. Very meticulous. So a lot of the research came out of that.
How much of this story is actual nonfiction, fact rather than fiction?
One of the challenges was trying to be as factually based and grounded in the concrete and the real while still telling a fictional story. So the corner at which he was killed, for instance, just to delineate, that was actually the corner where he was killed. They needed a street with a stoplight so the car would stop. There was a pickup truck that stopped. That scene is repeated and slowed down in the story, so I had to try and be as precise as possible.
But it's really getting into the minds of the characters. That is the fun, the invention.
Yeah.
One of the stories, Officers Weep, reads like a police log.
Yeah.
Your antagonists, again, your protagonists aren't named, except by badge number.
I took the train to work, 20-minute train ride, when I lived in the Bay Area, and the only time I had to read was to read police blotters. And I got fascinated by the stories that are told in those incidents, and I decided to try and tell a story with those incidents, and the only thing that came up was a love story between two cops. That's all I could come up with.
Well, these stories were written over the span of 15 years or so.
Mm-hmm.
When you went back to the early ones, did you see a major change in the way you think about stories, or have you been pretty consistent?
The one thing I've been pretty consistent about is that I look at each story as a discrete project. In other words, I don't really think of what went before it or what's going to come after it. What's worked out is that they have somehow coalesced into a collection that seems to present a kind of worldview. And that wasn't intended at all, not at all.
It's just that's the way your mind works.
Yeah.
Will
yeah.
people be surprised when they read the novel, or will they see that as coming from that same mind?
Half and half. The novel's very different in style and subject matter, but I would say it's coming from it's populated with the same kinds of people as in this collection.
And how long before we have to wait to read that novel?
Everybody's been asking that. I'll just say a couple of years.
Daniel Orozco's stories have appeared in Best American Short Stories, Best American Mystery Stories, Best American Essays, and the Pushcart Prize Anthology, as well as in publications like Harper's Magazine, Zoetrope, All Story, McSweeney's, Ecotone, and Story Quarterly. And now there is a collection published under the title Orientation and Other Stories. It's from Faber and Faber. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks for inviting me.